I want you to hear this statement and mark it. A child is not cursed because they're reared in a single parent unit. As a matter of fact, I believe it is better for a child to be reared by one healthy parent in a single parent situation than two sickies in a sick relationship. The reason I say that is after 25 plus years of pastoral counseling, I've had the aftermath of too many children who come in. They now are adults, married. They're sharing how that they have been on a tremendous guilt trip for a number of years because mom stayed with dad or vice versa, and they kept reminding the child, I did it for you, and they saw all the pain and agony that the child experienced, and they felt like they were responsible, they were guilty for causing their parent this trouble. Or they will be in a situation, they have a few problems, they go home and visit with their parents over a holiday vacation. They see how their parents are coexisting in a state of tension. They see the unhappiness. They come back and have an argument, and they run because they cannot see themselves 30 years down the line in the same position that they see their parents. So they run from the marriage too quickly. Therefore, I tell people over and over again, do not keep the marriage together for the sake of the children. You will do the children an injustice. Make it or break it for yourself, but make sure you work at it from that perspective. Now that you've gotten that truth, what do you believe is the most important thing you can give your child? Someone, what do you think is the most important thing you can give your child? Love? Help? Okay, somebody knows, and they've already jumped the boat on me, but listen to me carefully. The most important thing you can give your child is a healthy parent. You see, everything else, love, approval, affection, understanding, all these things flow out of that healthy parent. That means, first of all, you've got to deal with your bitterness, because any bitterness that you have will ultimately be directed towards the child. Every time you look at that child, you will see that former mate in that child. If that former mate had a particular characteristic that you could not stand, you'll look and there it will be right in that child. And you'll find yourself wanting to just pour out all that hostility and all those feelings on that child. So you've got to deal with it. One day I received a phone call from the hospital. A 14-year-old girl had attempted suicide. I went in and sat down with her. In just a few moments, she was able to share with me the problem. Her mother and dad had divorced when she was quite young. Her dad, from all sources, was a hellraiser. All mom had done for 14 years was tell daughter what a no good man daddy was, and so, because of all the bitterness that mother had, daughter had attempted suicide to force mother to let her go live with her daddy. So you got to get rid of that bitterness so that you can allow that child to be themselves. Allow them to develop those qualities that are in the other mate. Kathy and I were laughing one day. Our younger son, who was still at the house, had gone with us on a trip because we were going to Austin. His older brother was in school there. And as we were driving along, Chris began to talk, and you could listen to him, and Kathy looked at me and smiled, and I knew exactly what she was thinking. He was talking exactly like his father, whom he had not seen in 6 months. Why? Because that's part of his personality. It's him. So you've got to deal with your bitterness. Do you know the reason why I believe so many parents are abusive parents? They were abused children. And until they resolve the bitterness towards their abusive parent, they'll say, I'm not going to do that, but they'll come right around and do the same thing that they swore they would never do because of that resentment that is still in them. Then you got to have a healthy self-love, because only as you have a healthy self-love can you give that child freedom to be themselves, to develop their own personality, and not feel compelled to make them to be exactly like you want them, or to face the fact that one day the teacher will call and says, do you know what your child is? Not my child. Yes, your child. In other words, you've got to allow them to be human. They're going to make mistakes. They're just like you. So you give them that permission. You allow them that freedom. What then is the second most important thing you can give a child? A healthy respect for the other parent. Because the child is a unique composite of both parents. So therefore, you've got to come to the place that you emphasize the good that was in that parent. Some of you, because of resentment, may be finding yourself thinking, what good? And you have to scrape away a lot of garbage before you can find that goodness. But let's face it, there must have been something good about the person, or you would never have married them in the first place. So you need to emphasize the good qualities, but at the same time, you need to be honest. We have a tendency to deify the deceased and devilify the divorced. You lose a mate by death, there's a tendency to make him so big, and the child feels very frustrated because daddy or mother is bigger than God, and how do I measure up? Now, if it's a divorce situation, how to overcome the heritage that I have, you know, what he was or she was, how do I ever get big enough to become better than that, stronger than that? You got to emphasize the good and be honest, and part of that emphasizing the good and being honest is do not play games with them. One area in which there are games that are frequently played that I think can be very destructive is if dad never makes contact with a child, sometimes what will happen is the mother will send letters through a friend as if they were coming from daddy, or send a gift that way. Don't do that, because ultimately the child will find out what is going on, and they'll find themselves thinking, dad disappears, mom lies, whom then can I trust? And so I say, give them a healthy respect for the other parent. He said, but Clive, what about a missing parent? One lady came to me one day and says, my husband died when I was 8 months pregnant. What am I going to do for my child? I said, well, do you have pictures of you and your husband, or pictures of your husband? Yeah. Well, keep them around. She said, but what if I remarry? I said, listen, if you remarry and the man you marry does not have enough self-esteem and self-love to allow you to have pictures of the former mate around for the children, and to acknowledge that that is a part of your life that cannot be denied, that person does not have sufficient self-esteem to marry. We laugh about it, but Kathy has a picture of the boy's father in the boy's bathroom. That may seem like an odd place, but it goes with the color scheme of the bathroom as the reason. There are other pictures of other places. A lady came up one day at a seminar and says, Clive, we have a rose gallery, if you will, in our home. There's one wall in which we have all these pictures. My former mate just remarried, and my son wants to put a picture of he and his new wife on the wall. I learned that she was about to get married again. I said, oh, when you get married, are you going to put a picture of you and your new husband on the wall? Oh, yes. I said, your son has as much right to have that picture as your picture on the wall. You realize that? You see why you got to get rid of the bitterness? Because if you don't deal with the bitterness, you cannot accept that and allow that person to be a vital part of their lives. I'm glad when people are able to get to the place that they are able to encourage their children to be present at the wedding of their parent when they marry again, to be a part of it and let them know, hey, you have permission to be there and to love that person and to love that new mate, because only as they are given permission to love the other mate's new mate will they ever have permission to love your new mate when you remarry. It's almost like they need a permission. It's almost like, well, if I love daddy's new wife, I'll be disloyal to mom. No, you're not. You have that capacity, but they need that permission slip from mom to say it's okay. And so I'm saying, get to that place that you can give them that permission by allowing pictures, keeping pictures around, and showing them so that they can be a part of it and be excited about it. Then you've got to get in touch with your child's feelings. You see, I believe that the child experiences some of the same feelings that you experienced when the marriage ended by death or divorce. First, confusion. That feeling of confusion, what happened? Frequently in a divorce situation, the children will play games. They'll get in and play with their dolls or even their animals, and daddy's on a business trip. He's gone away and hasn't come back. Or daddy's working for an oil company in Saudi Arabia. Oh, does he send you letters from Saudi Arabia? Well, daddy's on a secret mission with the CIA. But when he gets off that mission, he's going to come home and we're going to spend a month together. Hey, Clyde, he's lying. No. He's trying to deal with something that is so hard for him to handle that he finds himself creating an artificial situation as a means of getting in touch with some of his feelings. So he finds himself feeling a sense of confusion and then rejection. As I said, Charles Solomon says that the number one experience a child can have of rejection is the premature death of a parent. In a divorce situation, the feeling is not helped when somebody walks up and says to a little child, "How could your daddy walk out on such a lovely child as you and your mother?" You know, when I hear that, I almost believe they're saying that mom's a child too. It's that idea of walk out on a child. Listen, occasionally it happens. Occasionally the man will walk out on the children. Occasionally a woman will walk out on the children because she cannot handle the responsibility, the burden. But most of the time, it is not the children that are the problem. It's the relationship between the husband and wife. And I know that sometimes men who do not have as much contact with their children as they want find themselves being blocked, not because of their feeling towards the child, but because of the amount of bitterness that exists between that man and his former mate. I've been counseling with a man who, because of the bitterness that his wife had, every time he went to visit with the children, she'd react, and even afterwards he'd leave and bring the children back, she'd react. And he felt so burdened seeing the children go through all the agony that they were experiencing that he made a choice just to disappear from their life. But he felt guilty and felt burdened. He missed his children every day of his life. He remarried and spoiled two stepchildren. Through all of that, though, he never lost that desire. And as we experienced the counseling, he came to the place of acknowledging, "I really would like to see my children, but I'm afraid. I don't even know where they are." He found out where they were, and then he had the trauma. How do I walk back into their life after having been absent so long? What am I going to say to them? And that feeling and that sense of rejection that he's experienced and knows how they experience. But the feelings are primarily towards parents, and if the parents get over their bitterness, the children prosper from it because then the other person feels free to come and go and visit with the child. Then, anger. Anger and death, very definitely. And it's not help when someone walks up and says, "Oh, don't you understand, honey? God needed another angel, and so he called your dad to be an angel in heaven." And the child's thinking, "Hell, God, why don't you take Billy's dad? He's never home anyway." Now, that's what the child's feeling. They can't say it because they're shocked. But that's where their feelings are right now. They're feeling anger at God in a death situation. Sometimes anger towards the parent who died. I was counseling with a lady one day, and she had never put her finger on the anger that she had towards her father. Father died when she was 4 years of age, but the anger was here. She wanted to go swimming. There was never the 25 cents to pay for the admission. "Why can't I get roller skates?" "Well, Daddy's died, you know, there's no money." And so she kept feeling, "Daddy, because you died, I don't have money to do all these things." And there was an anger. In a divorce situation, the anger is normally directed towards towards the custodial parent. Now, I don't like those terms, so you're going to find that I will probably use the mother more often as the custodial and the father as the non-custodial. Bear with me. I know that there are men who have custody of their children, and I understand this, and I believe some men have every right. I know of a lot of men that would like to have custody of their children, but it's a situation where both mother or father would make good parents, and so they, rather than put the children through a lot of problems, have just backed up and said, "I'm not going to put them in a court battle like that," and they've allowed the other parent to go ahead and have custody, but they have that same love for their children. All we're dealing with, as we're talking about the terms, is just to keep from using those non-personal terms. If I use the mother more often as the custodial, you'll understand and bear with me, man, right? All right. I find that frequently the anger is directed not towards the non-custodial, but the custodial, because you see, if child directs the anger, say, towards daddy who comes and visits with them every other week, they're afraid daddy will not come back and visit with them next time it's his turn. So what happens, they come home and dump it on mama. Any of you have noticed this? Your children go visit with their dad, come back home, and Monday, all of a sudden, that child just got, you know, they're just touchy. And if you say something, they blow up, and you look and say, "Well, don't blow up at me. I didn't do anything." All that does is pours gasoline on the fire, which you say, "Wait a minute. Did you and daddy have a problem this weekend?" You stop and let them start talking about it. And as they talk it out after they finish, resist the temptation to pick up the phone and call that former mate and say, "You sorry so-and-so," because you see, children are masters at playing one parent against the other, and they go to graduate school in a divorce situation. Many of them get their doctorate. So what you do after you say, "Listen, got a problem here, I tell you what. Here's the phone, here's Daddy's number. Why don't you call Daddy and talk to him about it?" Encourage them to dialogue about that situation. Then there's a feeling of guilt. I mean, bitterness first. Bitterness comes up because the child has this anger, and if they do not resolve the anger, the bitterness explodes. Bitterness is nothing more than infected anger. Listen to me carefully. I am now convinced that the number one reason for the breakup of marriages of children whose parents got a divorce is because of the unresolved bitterness towards their parents. Did you catch what I just said? Mom and dad go through a divorce. The child has tremendous bitterness towards dad. That child, the female, marries. What happens? That bitterness that she has towards her dad is transferred to her own husband. And ultimately, they find themselves splitting. And I am turning to people more and more and saying, "Listen, if you're going to have healthy children, you're going to have to help them deal with the bitterness they have towards you and towards the former mate." How do you do that? Well, I believe that anyone 9, 10 years of age can take the unit on how to trust after being burned, and they can do it just like you have. As a matter of fact, I do it in a teenage seminar. I was doing it one time for a group of teenagers that we had a lock-in. 7th through 12th graders, mind you. Locked into a holodome in Shawnee, Oklahoma. 4:30 Saturday afternoon, not a one of them had gone to sleep. But they were listening, and they were talking for the next 3 weeks about that, dealing with the bitterness towards their parents and others, because they realized they had to deal with it. You've got to help them. Now, if the child is younger than that, you may have to help them by being the scribe for them. Any of you familiar with these user-friendly computers? They ask you the next question, you type in the answer, and then it asks you the next one, and you type it in. What you do is you say, "Okay, what did Daddy do or Mom do?" You write it down. "What else did you do to hurt you?" Write it down. You write it down for them. "What did you feel like doing when Daddy did that?" Write it down. Well, you go through it and you do the scribe work for them. Then afterwards, you help them come back and take that red mark so out, and you help them go through that process of forgiving, because until they can forgive their father or their mother, they will not be able to be a healthy child. And then there's that feeling of guilt, tremendous feeling of guilt, because, "Wait a minute, Clyde, why? What'd they do? In a death situation." Well, there are two reasons for it. One, the two arguments that children overhear in parents most often are money and discipline. Right? Dad dies of a heart attack. What happened? Heard that Mom and Dad arguing about Daddy having to work to get another pair of jeans. What if I'd never been born? They would not have needed the jeans, and Daddy'd still be alive. Or they had an argument about discipline. Dad went out and got drunk, got killed in the car. "I killed Daddy." In a divorce situation, they hear the arguments. "I blew them up. If I had never been born, they would not have argued. And they'd still be together. I caused the divorce." And we've got to help them realize, wait, parents have got to assume responsibility for themselves. So you cannot blame someone else for what they did. And then a sense of what now? If Mom and Dad cannot get along, how in the world can I expect me to be a whole person when they're not whole? Kind of a sense of futility. How am I going to make it? How am I ever going to become a whole, healthy person? Now that we have begun to get in touch with their feelings, we can begin to meet their needs. Because you see, love is basically meeting needs. And so we look and find, first of all, that need to belong. There are two things that I think are very important here. The first one is that oftentimes, especially in a divorce, the child says, "Where do I belong? Do I belong with Mom or Dad?" Listen to me carefully. Child custody does not deal with to whom the child belongs. Child custody only says who has legal rights of custody. The child still belongs to both parents. Are y'all with me there? And I think children need to understand this, that you still belong to both of us, you still relate to both of us, and we still both love you. The other part of that sense of belonging is a sense of security. For invariably what will happen is something like this. You come in, you just learned how the former mate is just living it up. No responsibilities, and you've had to come in, cook supper, wash your dishes, wash clothes, help children with the homework, and all these good things. The child's kind of edgy. And after a while, the child says, you don't love me, I'm going to live with daddy. You want to say, can I help you pack your bags? That's when you bite your tongue and count to 1,000. 10 is not enough. And after you finish telling, you say, listen, I hear you, how you feel, and I understand how that could be. But I just want you to know, sometimes I get as bad as you do, and sometimes I almost would get mad enough to say, yeah, it would be good. But don't you understand I love you and you have a place here because I love you. And I'm providing a place for you because of love. A sense of belonging, and then a sense of acceptance. A sense of acceptance that says, I love you, warts and all. It looks at that person, and you see those personality traits that remind you of the former mate, and you say, oh, I love those qualities. You know, Chris, our son walks just like his dad. He's got the same knees. He stumbles through a room. I mean, just like, and every time you look at him, you say, okay, I know who that is. That's Jim. That's just something we understand. We accept it perfectly all right. That's part of life. You allow them to think like. I mean, he's got an ability. He's got a personality. I think he could con anybody. I'm talking like Chris. I mean, just part of his personality. He's got that pleasant personality. It's just beautiful to see it work at times. I'm fearful at other times. But you can understand what I'm getting at. And the thought is perfectly understandable. You have to learn to accept it. Wait a minute, Clyde. I hear that accepting, but there's one part I have a little problem with. What's that? Earlier you said that I'm not to go around picking up behind my son all the time. Well, Clyde, he's not casual. He is a slob. What am I going to do? I said, okay. I think what you need to do is this. Once a week, you make him pick up his room, even if it necessitates a wheelbarrow, pickaxe, and shovel. Probably Friday afternoon or Saturday morning, and the rest of the time, you close the door and ignore it. You know, go by it real fast. But the rest of the time, you come in and you make him pick it up once a week, but you learn to accept and promote those qualities that make that child unique. You give them a sense of acceptance, then you give them a sense of approval. Do you know what a temper tantrum is? It's an attempt to get your attention by being bad. When I was in seminary, one of the graduate students was busy typing his dissertation. His wife was a secretary. When he did not have to be at school, he was at home typing. He had 2 children, a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. 5-year-old was always doing something mean to the 2-year-old. And one day, the 5-year-old took a broomstick and knocked the living daylights out of the 2-year-old. And daddy, like any Baptist preacher type there, pulled him up by the neck and said, why'd you do that? As he started to lay one on his rear end. Charles said, so you'd pay me some attention. And it dawned upon him, the child that was 2 years of age was not potty trained and so forth. And he was always going to say, need to go potty, need water, need this, need this. The 5-year-old, he ignored except when he was bad. A temper tantrum is a child's way to get your attention. And what happens? The normal tendency is when they throw a temper tantrum, you get down in the middle of the floor and fight back with them, right? You argue just with back with them. Well, did you? Ha ha. I hooked you. You know how you break a temper tantrum? Send them to their room and ignore them while they throw the temper tantrum. Then when they get over the temper tantrum, bring them back out into the room, and anytime they do anything right, lavish praise upon them, because you see, after a while, the child will realize, I get attention by being good. The average parent spends 4 times as many words criticizing as complimenting. And I think we need to reverse that. We need to learn the value of positive reinforcement. My pastor had a tendency to say, you're one of the good guys. It was his way of saying, I like you. But I know that was good, but I'd much rather somebody be specific and say, kind of like this, or this, or this about you, rather than that vague term, you're one of the good guys. But they need approval, and we need to give children approval. We need to lavish it upon them so that they can know that we like them and what we like about them. Then, I need to give my children understanding. I'm sorry, affection. Affection's next. I need to give a child affection. We all need it. I'd be so glad when men learn how to give a child affection in some way other than playing the airplane. You know what I'm talking about? Get the child under their armpits and kind of throws them up in the air, and the child goes, "Wee! I'm glad Daddy's taking me up. Please, Daddy, don't drop me." You know, that fear but glad. Why is it so many men have trouble sitting a child on their lap and reading a story or just talking to them? I was recently visiting with my daughter and son-in-law, and here's my bulky 6'4", 235-pound son-in-law playing with my precious little 3-year-old granddaughter, bouncing her head off the floor. You know, just kind of, not literally, but it seemed like that. She was at least an inch away, but it seemed like her head was hitting the floor, and I just wanted to say, "Hey, can't you have any affection any other way?" You know, I understand. Men, that teenage daughter would still occasionally like something from Daddy, like a touch on the shoulder, maybe a kiss on the cheek. And ladies, that gawky 16-year-old football player would occasionally like a kiss from Mama at the appropriate time. But in front of his fellow gawky football players, he is not being kind. He'll rub it off out of embarrassment at that time. So learn that and give her that sense of affection when they need it. Relate to them. Let me give them understanding. Now, understanding necessitates two things. First, time, and then freedom of expression. Have you ever felt like the older you get, the faster time flies? Do you know why? Stop and think about it. To a 4-year-old, 1 year is 1/4 of a lifetime, of their whole existence. To a 40-year-old, it's 1/40th of a lifetime. Therefore, segment-wise, it is 10 times smaller to a 40-year-old. So when you, as a 40-year-old, say to a 4-year-old, "We'll do that next week," it is as if you were saying to that child, "We'll do it 10 weeks from now." So you need to remember this and keep that in mind as you relate to that child. Make the time frame smaller for young children. You need to give them some time when they need it occasionally. Not all the time. I was helped immensely by a Church of Christ minister who, pastoring in the San Francisco during the hippie craze, came to realize, "My children need me. I'm so busy at the church, I'm never home with my children." So he decided Thursday night, stay home night with the kids. And said, "Oh no, Thursday night, I play Monopoly with Daddy." One evening, he was talking to a lady on the phone who did not know how to say bye. Two deacons in the car, blowing the horn. "Bomb, bomb, come on, preach, we're late for a meeting." And his 8-year-old son, "Daddy, Daddy, I got to talk to you." And it dawned upon him, "My child needs me right now." He told the lady on the phone, "Mama, sir, an emergency has come up. I've got to go. Bye." And I told his wife, "Tell the deacons I'll be on down to the church." Reached up and did his test and says, "Okay, son, what is it?" Began to talk to his son. 5 minutes later, he walked out of the house on his way to church. And his son thought he had the greatest dad in the world. The children need some alone time with a parent. I know of a couple that went through a divorce. Both of them wound up at different times going to picking up the pieces. The man walked to his former wife and said, "Listen, our children need some alone time. I tell you what, periodically, maybe every 3 or 4 months, when it's my weekend to pick up the children, there were two, I'll pick up one, say the son, and leave the daughter with you. That way, that weekend, we will have alone time with a child. The next weekend, I'll come and swap. I'll take the daughter and leave the son with you, and we'll have alone time with the opposite child. Then I'll go back to the normal procedure for a while, and we'll rotate like that periodically." I love that thought, because here they were reaching out to take care of the children and meet the needs of the children. Love will do that for a child. But also a child needs freedom to express themselves, to share what they're feeling and what they're thinking, even when that may be different from what you think they ought to think or feel. I was doing a live radio show in Tucson, Arizona. A lady hit me with a question that I was not expecting. We were talking about picking up the pieces, but she says, "Clyde, what is this thing called the generation gap?" This answer came to me on the spur of the moment. I wish I had said it years ago. I said, "When I was 21, 22 years of age, I looked at my world and said, my world is not perfect, and so I set out to change my world. I made some changes, but change is tiring. It's exhausting. And after a while, I got to be 40, 42 years of age, and I got tired of always pushing against the obstacles, and I looked and said, my world's not perfect, but it's better. So I settled in to accept my world. About that time, my children became 21, 22, and they looked and said, I don't like my world. It's not perfect. And so they went out to change their world. The same thing I did. The only problem was they were trying to change my world. And that's the generation gap. It's the gap between the two of us as we relate one to another to our world and as we see it. We need to give that child the freedom to express what they're experiencing. A lady shared in a seminar how that her son came home and used a couple four-letter words. She said, when I picked up my false teeth, I turned to my son and said, son, do you understand what you were saying? He said, no, Mom, I just heard the words at school. They sounded good, so I used them. Mom sat down and began to explain to the child what the words meant and why she would prefer that he not use them. As she finished, mother and the child said, Mom, I don't know if that's what they meant. If that's what they mean, I'll not use them anymore. And then with tears in his eyes, he looked at his mother and said, Mom, I'm so glad that you're my mom instead of Billy's mom being my mom. She said, why, son? And he said, because when Billy used these words, all his mother did was wash his mouth out with soap. You've at least helped me understand what it's all about. They need to have that freedom to express what's going on in their world and what they're experiencing. But there's another part of that freedom to express what they're feeling. They come home after visiting with Daddy over the weekend. They bow and say, Mama, Daddy's got a new girlfriend. And Mom, she's a size 7. And you haven't been a size 7 since you were 5 years of age. And Mom, she's so much fun. Mom, we went down to Dallas and she rode the shoot-to-shoot and the roller coaster. And you're just paranoid because you wouldn't even get near. You even got on the... And you're letting the child talk and have so much fun and be so excited. And you're so excited for the child, right? Oh, am I detecting there's still some bitterness there? The other side of it is the child comes in and starts talking, Mom, that woman spanked me. And your first reaction is to pick up the phone and call the former maid and says, don't you let that... And you probably use a few words that are not repeatable on tape. Touch me, that child again. And I say, don't. I know there are cases of abuse. But I want us to not get in the ditch where every time we see somebody touch a child, it's abuse. Because you see, if a child does not learn that they have authority and can be disciplined in the home of the non-custodial parent as well as the custodial parent, they will not respect authority anywhere else, at school, in the government, or anywhere. You give them that freedom to express themselves. You give them understanding, and you listen to them and get involved in their lives and let them and find out where they are and what's going on in their world. Then you give them discipline. Now, discipline is a means by which you help a child develop an internal value system. In doing this, I think we need, first of all, to avoid the two ditches that happen among single adult parents. The first of these is, my poor child, they're in a single parent family, so you spoil them to death. The other extreme is, I failed as a wife, I'm not going to fail as a mother, so you try to make that child a perfect child, and both are impossible to maintain. What you need to do is to learn that the way you help your child develop a sense of responsibility is by setting limits. These are the limits that you utilize as you develop an internal value system. Now, in helping a child develop an internal value system, one of the things you must avoid is the phrase, because I said so. See, when you say that, basically what you're doing is defending your authority. You're not helping the child reason why something is right or wrong. Now, you tell the child may or may not agree with you, they may or may not understand, but at least you have dealt with them in a way that they can relate. You give them those values. You set the limits. I think another thing we've got to watch is this. The typical situation is we go at it backwards. We laugh at and excuse the behavior of a two-year-old and a three-year-old. It's just the terrible twos and the horrible threes and the rancid fours and whatever it might be. And then they get to be 12 or 13, and all of a sudden we try to tighten the screws and wonder why they snap and break. So I take a young branch and twist it, and twist it into five circles, and it will not break at all. But if I take an old branch and try to do that, it'll snap in five places. I think what we ought to be doing is very tight limits on a two-year-old, and the older the child gets, the more freedom we give them, until the day that we can pull back and let them be on their own. We're trying to help them become morally responsible. Now, as I try to help a child develop that sense of value, I build it around these words: responsibility brings rewards. Irresponsibility brings punishment. I think a child needs a list of their responsibilities, and as soon as a child can read and write, these ought to be written. So the child can see it. There's no misunderstanding those written words. Well, I know that's what you meant. It's in paper. Here it is. And you signed on the dotted line and says you understand. If you fulfill your responsibilities, you earn privileges. The only thing I owe my children is love and affection and understanding, approval, affirmation, food, housing, and plain pockets. That's Jacques Panay's plain pocket genes. Calvin Klein, Gloria Vanderbilt, whatever may be the end thing they earn by responsible behavior. Do you get it? Here's what I owe you. Here's what you can earn by being responsible. TV, stereo, bicycle. I agree with Dennis Waitley when he says that no one ought to buy a car for a child. When a child is old enough and has enough money to buy the car, you will co-sign with them, but they've got to be old enough to pay for it and pay for the insurance and the gas themselves, or they will find it winding up on the junk heap. What are you doing? You're teaching responsibility earns privileges. But as in the business world, if you do not fulfill your responsibilities, what happens? You lose privileges. And then if you don't do it often enough, you get fired. That's all we're trying to teach. Now, in discipline, I think one thing we must do is we should be careful that we do not overload our mouth. If I say to a child, if you do that, I'm going to do so-and-so, and I overload the punishment, what will happen is the child will do it, and I'll feel guilty, so I'll back up, oh, that's too serious a punishment. But they've got to know the limits, so they're going to do it again. Oh, that's right again. They'll do it a third time. Now I'm starting to get mad. And the next time they do it, bloom, I explode in anger. And the child does not hear discipline. What do they hear? Anger. That's confusing. What you ought to do is have such a minor punishment the first time that the first time the child does it, bam. Now then they've heard, here's the principle, here's my responsibility, here's what happens if I do not. They've heard responsibility, privilege, punishment. What about the right to enforce your lifestyle in your home? As long as a child lives under my roof, they will live by my lifestyle. When they're able to provide for themselves, they can make their choice. Counseling with a lady who had a son 17 years of age who was on drugs. She said, I cannot stop him outside the house, but I do not want drugs in my house. We talked to him. I talked to her. Finally, I said, it's time you made him make a choice. What do you mean? I said, let him choose whether he wants the key to the house or freedom of his drugs. Kick him out of the house? No, make him make the choice. Which is most important to him? She approached me. She said, you're not going to take away my drugs. She said, I'll take your key. She had to change a couple locks, bolt a few windows. 6 months later, there was a knock on the door. Mom, if I give up my drugs, can I come home? She said, welcome home, son. Do you know where I got the concept? Look in Luke chapter 15. Check it out. By the way, I got a call 2 years ago. A man in his 20s says, Clyde, are you still doing counseling? I said, yes, I am. He said, well, I'm having some problems with my girlfriend. Can I come see you? We set up a time. He came in, sat down. He said, you remember me? It was that young man. He knew I was the one that led his mother to make him make that choice. And he respected me enough that when he had problems, he came to see me and talk with me about it. Then you've got to help a child develop a sense of identity. A sense of identity in recognizing, first of all, that every child is unique. There are no two exactly alike. They used to ask me how many children I said. I had three, one of each kind. I now have six, one of each kind. Every one of them is unique because they're a unique combination of their parents and their own individual situations. Now, if I help a child develop a sense of identity or roles, I'm not talking about who cooks and who cuts the grass. To be honest with you, I prefer to cook and my wife prefers to cut the grass. I think one of the reasons she married me is because I like to cook. She really doesn't like it. And that's fine. I like it. That's not a sissy thing to do. It's okay. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about some of the things we dealt with earlier in that chapter on the battle between the sexes, helping them realize there are some differences. Now, I think there are two things that you've got to do. First of all, you must avoid the man of the house role. Invariably, when you become a single parent, ladies, somebody will turn to your oldest male child and say, "Now then, you've got to be the man of the house. Get that person out very quickly and tell the child, understand, under no circumstances are you to be the man of the house. Because if they're a man of the house, they'd be man of the bedroom." You've also got to recognize that some of them will just assume it. I've seen 6 and 7 and 8 year old boys, "Who's that phone call from? What's that bill for? What's that letter about?" One day an 8 year old boy came in, "Mom, how much money have you got in the bank?" "Mom, you've been around children too long, you're a school teacher. Get Judy and y'all go out somewhere." And you notice, a lady, not a man. The only thing you can do when a child gets into that situation is the me, Taurus, and you, Jane talk. It's very simple. It goes like this. "Me, Mom, you, Son, don't forget it. Repeat it as often as necessary." I conducted a wedding for a lady, and man, I got a call one day from the lady about 4 months later. She's crying. I said, "What's the matter?" She began to talk, and I sensed the problem. She had married a man whose former wife had been sick for a year before death, in the hospital, all except one day of that year. And then he'd been single a year and a half. So for 2.5 years, his teenage daughter had been the lady of the house. Married, and this daughter wasn't about to let this new woman come in. I called the man. I said, "Hey, what's going on?" He says, "Glenn, I hate to admit it. We got a problem." I said, "You know what it is?" He said, "Yeah." "What are you going to do about it?" He says, "Well, Clyde, I love my wife." I said, "Well, you know what you've got to do." He said, "Yep." He'd heard the seminar. That evening, he set his daughter down across from him in the table in the dining room. He says, "Honey, I love you. You're my daughter, and I will always love you. But the woman in the other room is my wife. And I'm telling you something. If somebody leaves this house, it's not going to be her. Because she is lady of this house. And I'm telling you, and you hear it." Got permission, got the word from Dad, she straightened up. Marriage is still going. Because, listen to me carefully, the husband-wife relationship has got to be first. The other is, do not let a child sleep with you. You let a child sleep with you, and invariably they're going to make an asphyxiation. They're crying. They're scared. I know they're scared. I'm thinking of a lady who was saying, "Well, what am I going to do?" Put them in their bed. Pat them, let them go to sleep. Go to your room, go to sleep. "Well, Clyde, you don't understand. They come get in my bed at night." Fine, wake them up and make them walk back. Don't carry them, make them walk so they'll experience it. "But Clyde, I don't wake up." Lock your door and put a doorbell so they have to ring it. If there's an emergency, they ring the bell. Otherwise, let them stay. They'll get the message. Hey, you may think that's kind of serious, but listen to me carefully. I had a lady turn to me recently in a seminar and says, "Clyde, I wish somebody told me that 5 years ago. My 9-year-old son has been sleeping with me for the last 5 years, and recently he started putting the make on me at night." If you do it with one of the same sex and you remarry, they'll resent your new mate because, you see, you're kicking them out of a very private part of their life and their lifestyle. You've got to find some models, some people that can be copies for you. And I tell you, go look at church. Find somebody at church. I had a young man, one of our singles departments, turned to two of the ladies in the class and said, "Listen, I'm going to take my daughter to see the Blue Angels. Can I take your sons with me?" One day, didn't you want them? Took them out there. They had a blast. I know of a deacon. He and his wife serve as deacons to single-parent units because they want to love those children. Things like that. I'm just simply telling you, find some models. Then, special considerations, very quickly. First, what about visitation? Do not probe. I think one of the worst things you can do when you pick up a child after a visitation or they come back is ask, "Well, what did you do?" Why? Because you put the child in a moral dilemma. What if daddy or mother has said, "Don't tell the other parent what we've done?" But Clyde, there's cases of abuse. There's a way of getting around that. Listen to me careful. To have fun. Now that you've not put him in a moral situation, and you can talk about the issues, and they can talk about it without being put in that tension. But see, it's not for you to probe, because that's part of the problem. I know there are those rare situations of incest, but I think there's some ways of dealing with it. The second thing is, do not spoil. I don't think you ought to try to make up for, in 2 days, the 12 days you do not have the child. You ought to treat them as if you had them every day of your life. And what do you do when you disagree with the lifestyle of the other parent? Every once in a while I'll have somebody come to me and says, Klein, I'm going to get the courts to forbid visitation. My so-and-so former husband, well, not even divorced yet. He picks up my precious children and he takes them over to his girlfriend's house and they spend a whole weekend over there and the children sit in the bed. Hey, I hear you, but listen to me carefully. If you forbid visitation, I promise you, 6 times out of 10, the children will ultimately adopt the other person's lifestyle. But if you will let them visit, teach them your lifestyle by example, teach them by your lifestyle by what you live, teach them to love the other parent in spite of what they're doing, they will come to the place that they'll have the freedom to love that parent and yet still reject their lifestyle, and 9 times out of 10, they will adopt your lifestyle. I shared this in a seminar. A lady wanted to come at me at the break time because she was so angry. She said, you just don't know. Fortunately, there were some ladies there, and they just came between us and said, listen to them. One lady said, I did what you're wanting to do, and I've lost my children. We're living the lifestyle that I hated so. Another said, I did what he said, and it works. Still others said the same thing. You teach them to love, and then you teach what real love is by your lifestyle, and they will ultimately adopt your lifestyle. What about dating? Dating is a part of the single life, and when you have children, you've got to recognize it's still a part of their life, too. Now, what I think you need to do, recognizing that dating is okay, come to the place that you occasionally involve the children in a date. Take them along with you. Go someplace that they can go with you. But be prepared for two things. First of all, when you take them along with you, what's going to happen is that child's going to want to plop where? Right between you. And there are times that that's perfectly okay. But Klein, I got this guy, and he's very special. We got this close relationship going. You know, he comes to the house, and we're watching television. I'm kind of laying up close to him. He's sitting there, and here comes that child, flop, right in the middle. Why? The child feels like they're losing their place in your life. So what do? Child comes, plops in the middle, and you look and say, hey, you like him? I like him too. I tell you what, you get on that side, and I'll get on this side, and we'll squeeze and make a love sandwich. Hey, I needed to make a love sandwich. I haven't lost my place, and they'll jump on the other side. And boy, the guy in the middle really enjoys it. The other thing is, guys, you'll come by to visit that lady you've been dating. Here comes that 8-year-old son. Hey, you going to marry my mom, huh? Now, man, that's not a proposal. What it is that child's way of finding out what's going on. Hey, Dad, what you up to? Be honest. No, we haven't even talked about it. That's okay. Okay. Well, we've been talking about it. We haven't made up our mind. Okay, that's fine. Well, we talked about it. We're kind of thinking about it. We may decide to do something. Yeah, let's see. Do I want you or not? I'll think about it later. They're gone. All they want to know what's going on, and then learn the secret of recognizing some affection is okay. The secret is, though, not to make out. Just recognize there are some okay affections. In other words, you're dating this guy, and he comes over and hugs you, kisses you. That's okay. You got this very special friend. He comes over and sits down beside you on the sofa, and y'all kind of snuggle up. There's nothing wrong with that. The child needs to see that it's okay for adults to relate one to another in love. That's fine. It's okay. Just don't make out in front of them. You know the limits. You understand what I'm talking about. But I want to share one other thought with you. And that's the thought of, what is the secret of step-parenting? Many of you face the reality that one day you may be a step-parent, and I include step-parenting for a child who is 1 year old or less to a child that's 99 years old. It's still step-parenting. You're 120 and the child's 99, and you're still a step-parent. Just because they left home doesn't change the situation. I want to give you the secret in one word. Two sentences of explanation. The secret of step-parenting is adoption. Not legal, but emotional. One should never remarry until they are willing to adopt the new mate's child or children as if they were your own, which is harder for the male because it speaks of financial responsibility, and until one is willing to yield for adoption, that is discipline, which is harder for the female. Then when you adopt, it's not yours, mine, and ours. It's ours, ours, and ours. Good, healthy relationship. Discipline becomes disciplining our children. You have to recognize one's coming from one place and one's coming from another place, and so slowly you bring them together and bring them to the place that they blend. What do they call you? Don't worry about it. You adopt them in time, they'll adopt you. I believe that's a real principle I'll never forget. The first time Chris, our youngest son who's still at home, called me Daddy, it was by mistake. We laughed about it. When we first married, he called me the Cajun cook. That's good. Called me Dad. Now he's kind of gotten to the place that I'm his dad and his father is his daddy. You know, it's kind of okay. It's worked out that way, and we understand it. But I firmly believe this. You adopt a child, and in time, a child will adopt you because they'll sense that love. I shall never forget my birthday 3 years ago. It was also the night our older son graduated from high school. We had invited the boy's father in for supper with us before we went to graduation. After we'd eaten gumbo that I prepared, Kevin opened his graduation presents that he had not opened, and then the boys gave their father a Father's Day gift and me a birthday present. As Jim, the boy's father, and I opened the present from Kevin, we found identical photographs that he had enlarged of a sunset on the Dead Sea Scroll. And I said, the Dead Sea. And then, as Jim and I again simultaneously opened the gift from Chris, again we found identical gifts, cups with the inscription, the world's greatest dad. You adopt a child, and a child will adopt you. The most important thing you can give your children is a healthy you.